So power versus simplicity. We cannot have both something that is very powerful and that is very simple to use. So if you look at how current software works, we'll see in a moment that you have software that is simple, very easy to use, and then you have other power tools. But you tend to not have things in between. So, as we've seen with those statistics, the trend has been to give more functions to users, to give them the illusion of power. But in practice, most users don't use all these features. And in fact, when you look at users transitioning from one version to the next, they always try to make the new one work like the old one. They usually are not interested in all the new stuff. So we end up with bloatware, too many functions, more functions with each new version, that people don't know how to use. This is part of what you get in some version of Word if you start opening the various toolbars. And in fact, it's even the marketing argument. If you look at the latest version of, iOS 5 came out recently, it's 200 new features. A new version of Word or Office comes out, it's, you know, several hundred new features. New features are always sold as something better. But as you add more features, they are harder to find, they are harder to learn, and they take more time to use. We saw it with Dialogbox. You know, when you used to have something that had an effect immediately, now you have to go through Dialogbox an extra step. And of course, it can get even worse by adding programming through macros or scripting languages or things like this, trying to tell users, well, you know, you can now program your own functions, but it requires a lot of skill to do this.
I don't really agree with the new features that I which maybe a lot to learn, but not really a lot to find the most steps to go to the good. For example, you use the word for Word, features, I take the example of the styles they put in recently, and it's a bit hard maybe to learn how it works, but once it works, you save a lot of time. That's particular features which are hard to read sometimes.
Well, hopefully. sometimes they do things right and they add new features that do save time in the long run. But at the time where I did that study, there was a sense that things were getting harder. I think you take the example of Word, and it's true that in recent versions they've really redesigned things to make things more, in a sense, easier to find because it was better organized. And some features do save you time. But there's one feature in Word that is, for me, has been getting worse and worse. It's when you try to put images in a paper, and it's completely unpredictable. So some things get better, some things get worse. But in general, there is this notion that we are going to add more features. And it's like, you know, if you go to the store and you buy, well, maybe you're not at a time in your life where you're interested in buying washing machines, but it will happen someday. And if you buy a washing machine, it's the same thing. They tell you, oh, this one has 47 programs, and this one is only 21. And the thing is, you know, I have a washing machine, I use two programs. So I think we see that in general, not just for computers. In general, in technology, technological products, the idea is that more features is better. And it's because marketing people have not figured out yet how to sell simplicity. And there are some exceptions, but in general, something that does fewer things that the previous version is not seen as something good. But if you look at the Xerox Star, they themselves said every new release we put out, we try to remove commands from the menu. And Steve Jobs is famous for saying that, you know, what's hard in designing things is not what to put in, it's what to take out. It's to make the decision what not to put in. So there's also a case by, and that's made by Doug Engelbart, that, you know, it's the bicycle versus the tricycle. Tricycle is easier to ride, but you cannot go fast because you cannot turn fast. With a bicycle, it takes more time to learn. Once you learn it, you can learn very fast. So it's a very tricky thing. But what I see is that the tendency is to put a lot of the design work on the shoulders of the user. I give you all these functions, all these new commands, all these things. It's up to you to figure out how to use it efficiently. And there are a few cases where it's done well, and simplicity has been driving the design. So I am painting things here darker than they are, but I think the general picture is that usually people find things harder to use with each version. And again, remember that you and me are not standard users, right? So the other trend that we see is, in fact, people realize that things are getting harder because they're adding things like those wizards to help you. So, you know, if the system were really that simple, you wouldn't need all these assistants and wizards and sort of the famous Clippy that was universally hated. But when you add a wizard, you sort of switched the model from a first-person interface to a second-person interface, right? Where you are, in fact, letting this assistant help you and teach you how to do something. And doing a wizard right is extremely difficult. If it does things properly, it will look wonderful. But the slightest mistake will look really terrible. So it also means that you have the sense of losing control. The wizard is telling you what to do. You're not telling the computer what to do. You're being told what to do. So again, it's not that I'm necessarily completely against wizards or these types of assistants. I think there are times where they're useful, but in general, they have been put in to solve a problem that shouldn't have been created in the first place. Another thing is the amount of preferences. Every time you add a preference, it's because you didn't want to make the decision for the user. So you let the user do it, and pretending that you are giving him the power. But how many standard users go into preferences and change things? Very few. And oftentimes, and there have been studies about this, when people go into the preferences, it's because they got a new version, they try to figure out how to make it work like the previous one. And this has been shown in practice. So, if you look at the cost versus benefits, what we see is that with the evolution from one software version to the next of the systems, simple things tend to get harder, and complex things tend not to be used because they are too complex and too hard to learn. Also, the things you have learned in one version do not translate in the next one. And that's the opposite of the bicycle thing. You know, once you learn bicycle, you never forget it, right? But with computers, you have the sense that once you learn something, the next version, they've changed it, and you have to relearn it. So you cannot capitalize on earlier learning a lot of the time. And the path from novice to expert becomes very hard. And you know, just look on the web how many entire sites are dedicated to using things like Photoshop. There are hundreds and probably thousands of sites full of tutorials and full of tips and tricks and I'm not saying this should not exist at all, but in fact, the conference I was at last week, there was an entire session by people with papers presented by people from Autodesk and from Adobe. So the people who Autodesk, they do Maya and they do Sketchpad and sophisticated tools. And Adobe, of course, they do Photoshop and Illustrator. And they have entire groups of people. They are working on how to improve their tools for learning how to use their systems. And there's also the cost of making choices. And there was research conducted recently, very interesting, on the cost of decision making. Every time you make a decision, it costs you literally energy. and the more decisions you make, the less good you are making decisions, because they cost you. And at the sensory motor level, even though I agree that it's not always the case that there are more steps, the fact that in general, oftentimes you add dialog boxes or you add features makes the simple things require more steps to So one approach that you've seen in the marketplace is, rather than trying to only have things getting more complex and arguably more powerful, things have started to, the market has started to segment. And so if you look here at video editing, on the Apple platforms, you have iMovie, which is arguably simple, although if you just take iMovie from version 1 to now, you can argue that it is still as simple as it used to be, but iMovie is meant to be simple to use. And then you have Final Cut Pro, which is the thing for a professional that you need to learn, and you can take, you know, week-long or month-long courses to learn how to use this, and it is used by professional editors to edit the movies in Hollywood and around the world. And if you are burning DVDs, you have iDVD and you have DVD Pro, same thing. And if you look at Adobe, they have Photoshop and Photoshop Elements. Although in those cases, what they do is they take Photoshop and they strip out a number of things. So it makes it simpler, but it's arguably a less good approach than really designing something simple from scratch. And you have a number of Photoshop-like systems now that have really tried to stay simple and not go into trying to do everything like Photoshop. So specializing software is something that I think is good. In fact, software is probably one of the only things where, you know, you don't have ranges of systems. If you go buy any car, any dishwasher, any radio, you will have a range of things to choose from. In software, in general, if you look at text editing, you know, if you don't use Word, what else are you going to use? So Microsoft only offers one version of Word, which is strange, because marketing a range of washing machines or toasters or cars costs money. Marketing software costs nothing. Building the software costs a lot, but once it's done, it's very easy to distribute. So even though distribution costs are low, it's strange to me that there are no such thing as a range of software. But that's the way it is. So the thing I'm interested in is not so much as deciding where to be on this curve. And I cannot get rid of the curve altogether. But maybe I can push the curve a little bit here. And that means that with the same level of simplicity, I may have a bit more power. Mm-hmm. Or I can reach the same level of power with more simplicity. Now, there are examples, and this is one of my favorite systems, was built in the, 90s, called Bryce. It was a 3D editor. It was the first time you had something where you could build complex 3D scenes without having to spend, you know, a month learning the system. And there was a number of interesting features in the software. For example, these palettes here would not show up unless your cursor moves in that area. So things would already look less crowded. And then the system would add some features would show up only after some time you had used the software. And then a number of things, we're using non-standard controls designed precisely to help with this complex 3D editing. And so, and there was this other screen to create what's called materials, which is an amazing combination of a lot of parameters from textures to characteristics of the lighting and all that. And when I compared the data for this tool, Bryce, with the ones I showed at the beginning, remember we had about 150 commands and 56 of them leading to a dialog box. In Bryce, you had 45 commands in the menus and 18 leading to a dialog box. A similar number of palettes, but the palettes were fixed and they would show up when you need them, when you go towards them, as opposed to using half the screen as is the case with the other one. So we had an interface with no menus, in the sense that, in fact, here you don't see the menu bar. The menu bar only shows up if you move your cursor at the top, and you can do an entire session without ever using the menu. No windows, in the sense that it's a full screen design. And again, no dialog box, except if you were using the menus, which you didn't really need to. But this thing here was sort of a giant dialog box where you have, I think, about 100 parameters that you can control in one screen. And obviously this thing was the result of a lot of design to make things accessible, and not using any of the toolkit that we're used to, so none of the regular buttons. These are sliders to show you how each parameter influences the various things. So a very visual way of showing you the controls for this complex editor. So, in between 1998 and 2000, I was I spent 2 years in Denmark. I was invited there, and I started a project where we were working with a research group that works on what's called colored picture nets. A picture net is essentially a bunch of squares and circles linked together with arrows. And this, in fact, is a type of automaton. So we have tokens in those round circles, which are called places. And there are rules that if there's a token here and an arrow here, then you can move the token through this. And then there's two output arrows, so three in fact. So this token will go here, and another one here, a copy of it here, and a copy of it will go back here. So this is something used to model parallel systems, and it's used heavily to model communication protocols and things like this. And it's nice because you can do mathematical proofs and all that. So there was a group there working on the theory of this thing, and they had been building a tool so you could create those networks with a mouse and keyboard for about 10 years. And their tool was sort of getting a little bit old and too complicated, and they asked us to redesign it. It was something that was already in use in 600 organizations, so doing a redesign was, we didn't know whether this would be the next version or if they would trash it. But it was an opportunity in trying some ideas in the context of a tool that has real users outside research. And so we created a system where first we decided to have it based on two-handed input. And so you're going to have a mouse and you're going to have a trackball on your left hand or non-dominant hand. You can swap them if you are left-handed. Because we knew from research that with two-handed interaction you can be more efficient at certain tasks. We also integrated a number of techniques that were new at the time, such as tool glasses, floating palettes I'll describe in a minute, and contextual menus were not new, of course, but we were going to use marking menus, the circular menus. And so here's a screenshot of the tool. And so what you notice is the diagrams are fairly
complex because in addition to all the graph itself, the arrows and the rectangles and the ellipses, there's a lot of text annotations here that describe how this thing works. And here we have an example where there's even more annotation because here the network is being simulated. So I'm running the program, if you wish, and I'm debugging it. So here it tells me there's one token in here, and this one is empty, etc. And I can run it step by step or for a number of steps at a time and see what happens. Now here we see one of the marking menus we're using. So these are radial menus. Here is a tool glass. So this thing floats over the screen and I have the left hand to move it. And with the right hand I can click and here apply color or thickness to the object. Here I have a palette that controls the simulator. So you can say play, stop, things like this. Here I can control what I see in the current window, so whether which annotations I want to show to decide how complex the drawing is. And here we have these dots here that show these dotted lines, the alignment lines, guidelines. I'll show a demo in a little bit. And on the left here we have all the elements in the in fact one PetriNet is made of multiple diagrams that sort of combine with each other. So I'm trying to recognize things here, but this is an enlarged part of this, so this and this are the same thing. But at the top level here, I have a sender, a network, receiver number one, receiver number two. And so receiver number one is detailed in here. So we have this hierarchical thing. So we did a lot of user studies and we showed that the context affects which tool the users prefer to use. So they tend to use a palette when they're focusing on the command. So if I want to add an annotation, for example, and then add a new, if I'm building my network, I tend to use a palette because the focus is on the command I'm using to do the next thing. The marking menu is better when you focus on an object. I'm looking at this object, and I want to change its color, and I want to change its annotation, I want to change this other attribute. So when I focus on the object, the marking menu is there, so I tend to use the marking menu. And tool glasses are good when you mix the two. And in fact, we did a study that showed that there was no situation where each of these was the best. It depends on the context. And that's a very important finding because it means there is no best solution. You cannot say, I'm going to do everything with marking menus and get rid of the rest because some people will find it hard to use. On the other hand, if you support all three, then you have the opposite problem, which is it going to be too complicated? Or are you going to add extra steps because you are using different tools? And we made sure that we could use palettes or tool glasses or marking menus at any one time without having to switch mode or do any of this. So we created a system where there was no menu bar, no title bars in the Windows, no scroll bars. The scrolling was like you have today on say the iPhone, where you only see where you are when you scroll, but the rest of the time you don't see it. No dialog box at all, and even no notion of selection. We didn't really need selection because all of the actions were on the objects. When I'm using a tool glass, I'm selecting the object as part of the action I'm applying. Same thing for a marking menu. So we didn't need selection to do all that. And so this worked because we used the participatory design process. We worked with users of the future system
And constantly we tested things out and we worked with them, see what were their ideas to do things. And also another thing is that we were able to have enough people developing the thing so we could start from scratch. And here, you know, this is running on a Windows machine, but there's nothing Windows-like on this. This was all done from scratch, including the Windows system. In fact, here you can see we have tabs. Now, this is common to see tabs, and particularly in web browsers, but at the time it wasn't. So we completely created the Windows system as well as all the content. Now, it's not graphically beautiful and as polished as could be done, but the fact that we did not have to build on top of an existing toolkit or Windows system gave us the freedom to do things differently. Now, if I have time at the end, I'll try to show a quick video. The main point here is getting to this notion of interaction model. Is the reason we were successful is because on top of the participatory design and having the freedom to do everything from scratch, we build on a strong interaction model. And this is what I want to talk about here. There's something else. Yeah, why is it a success? Because this system, after I left Denmark, they continued developing it. They made it the next major release of their system. And the last I looked, it had been downloaded by over 4,000 sites. And they keep track of that because to download, you need to ask for a license. So even though it's free, they keep track of who is really using it. So, when you think of PatronNets, it's not something that you have, you know, millions of people using to start with. So, I think everybody who uses PatronNets is using the system today, pretty much. So, what I mean by an interaction model, and this definition is vague, and I'm not happy with it, but it's a set of principles and rules and properties that guide the design of an interactive system. And it should help you combine interaction techniques in a consistent way. So, you know, for me, direct manipulation, as described by Schneiderman, is an interactive system because it tells you a number of things about what are the rules of a system that uses direct manipulation. But it's still a bit vague, and in fact, a lot of systems do a poor interpretation of direct manipulation. So ideally, a good interaction model is one descriptive. It allows you to describe a range of existing systems. Evaluative, it helps you evaluate and compare interactive systems. And ideally tell you this one is better than this one, but at least compare and figure out what is different. But the most interesting part is if it is generative, if it helps you create new interaction techniques, new interaction in general, that you wouldn't have thought of otherwise. Right? So it's not generative in the sense of automatic generation. It's generative in the sense, if I think in terms of direct manipulation, how would I have solved this problem? So, the reason why we need the new interaction model, and I've already shown this slide, is because direct manipulation is too often indirect. Right? So, I'll show the demos together. But so here, here's what I mean by indirect manipulation. So here's an example where I have objects that I can select. And say I want to change the size, so I'm going to look for a menu somewhere. Here's a menu. Oops, missed it.
And there's a bunch of commands here. You can figure out which is the right one. I guess I'll pick this one. And this was the change size. And here I have the change text box. And I can type another number. And I say OK. And here comes hello. And so even though I've done everything with the mouse and keyboard, it's not direct manipulation in my mind. Another more direct way would be to say, well, let's bring an inspector. And here I have a slider, so I can change the size, and I see immediately what happens. So it's more direct, because even though I'm not acting on the object itself, I can at least see in real time what's going on. And I can click another one here, and you see it will show me directly it's size 24, and I can adjust it. I can go back to this one. Now, of course, an even more direct way is to click on the handle here and to resize like this. Now, if you know of a tool that allows you to do this for text, you tell me, because I haven't found one. Usually, if it allows you to do this, it will do not the same scaling, horizontal and vertical. It will change the shape, which sometimes you want to do, but in this case, I don't. But I don't see why I cannot change the size of text like this. And in fact, this is compatible with Inspector. So here, I can change it like this. But I can also change it like this, and the inspector will tell me. So, I mean, this is a very simple example, but it shows the idea for what I mean by direct manipulation not being direct. So, all of this led me to come up with this notion of instrumental interaction. And the idea was to look in the real world and see how people interact in the real world. And you're all using pens to write and paper. And we're all using screwdrivers and hammers and things to do stuff at home. We use, you know, pens and pots and things to cook. And so humans really have developed the notion of using tools to interact with the real world as a way to enhance our capabilities to act on the world around us. So if I don't have a pen, it's very hard to write. But once I have a pen, I can write. So the tool gives me capabilities. And so why don't we use that notion in building interactive systems? In fact, it's already a little bit there, the fact that we have tool palettes, you know, with little icons that look like scissors and regular objects. There's already a little bit of that there. But can we push that further and say, you know, all interaction is going to be carried out through instruments? And so, in fact, what we have is a world where some objects are designed to be operated on. I call them the domain objects. Schneiderman called them the objects of interest. And then to operate on these objects, we have these interaction instruments. Now, an interaction instrument like a pen can, or a pencil here, can become the object of interest. If you break the lead, then you're going to, this becomes the object of interest, and this is the instrument, the sharpened instrument to fix the pen, the pencil. And then if your sharpener is broken, maybe you'll use a screwdriver to fix it, etc. So at any one time, you have a domain object and an instrument, but things can shift. So the conceptual model behind this is that the user is going to operate on the object of interest through an instrument. So physical actions on the instrument will provide direct feedback. When I'm touching the mouse, and I get kinesthetic feedback. When I'm operating here on the slider, I have visual feedback of what's going on. So immediate feedback of my action on the instrument. Then the instrument, in turn, operates on the object of interest through what I call command and response. And if I'm scrolling, for example, say I'm scrolling with the arrows here, it will send a scrolling command to the object, to the document. There will be a response here on the instrument, in that the little elevator here will go up and down. Plus, the content of the document will scroll, so it's a response, a direct response. And so this is what I call mediating interaction, because the instrument mediates the interaction between me and the object of interest. So one way to look at it is that an instrument turns a mode into an object. In our many systems today, you have lots of different modes, especially when you have these toolbars full of tools. If I select this tool, I'm in the mode where my action will create a rectangle. If I select this mode, this tool, I'm in a mode where I'm creating text, etc. So if instead of thinking of it as clicking buttons to switch mode, I think of it as I'm grabbing this instrument and then I use the tool, which can be done very easily by just changing the cursor as a way of showing what you have in your hand, then it becomes sort of natural. So these are temporal modes because I select them at a given point in time and then they are active until I switch to another one. When I use pointing to say I'm clicking this scroll bar versus the scroll bar versus somewhere in there, I'm using a spatial mode. But it's like if you have a mixing console and you decide to use one slider or another slider, each of these sliders is itself a tool. It does a particular thing. So what I find interesting is that many people say, you know, modes are terrible. And I've always said that modes maybe are terrible, but you cannot do without modes. And I think, in fact, instruments are a natural way to implement modes. And so I'll go quickly, very quickly, through the three levels I've described for a model: descriptive, evaluative, and generative. So descriptive, well, if you look at things we have in our systems today, a lot of it can be sort of interpreted as as an instrument. I've talked about scroll bars and some of these tools. But even the title bar of a window, it's not there to show you a title. It's there so you can grab it and move the whole window. So, you know, a window frame is really a handle for the window, and it's the instrument by which you carry the window around. But if you look at a lot of other techniques, I showed quickly dynamic queries in the first class, I think, droppable tools, which are these tools that you can leave on your document whenever you want. They don't have to be in the toolbar. The tool glasses I was talking about before were really inspired by the what's called French curves and physical tools. So all of the things are in fact examples of tools that are already out there. And if I go into non-graphical user interfaces like tangible interaction or augmented and mixed reality. In tangible interfaces, you use these little devices, bricks in this example, or there are other examples, really as tool to operate on the digital content. So the descriptive power here is that everything that uses notion of mediation can be captured by instrumental interaction. But there are things that don't fit in that model. If I think of a speech-based interaction, seeing that as a tool or an instrument is not really natural. So then the second thing is the evaluation aspect. Is there a way to compare instruments and say things about them? Well, one of them is this notion of degree of indirection. I was criticizing direct manipulation for not being direct enough. So can we characterize this directness? And here I have a graph with space over here and time over here. And what I put on this graph is the spatial offset is a distance between where you act and where the object reacts. So property boxes have a large spatial offset because it can be one side of the screen and the object the other side. Handles are on the object, so they are on the left. And then you have the time difference, which is the offset between when you do something and the time at which it has an effect. So data boxes are you know, they only affect the objects once you click OK. If I had the inspector that I showed, it would be lower on the time axis because it acts on the objects immediately. Drag and drop is also only operates at the end of the action, so it has a higher time offset. Now it doesn't. This doesn't say that you want to be at the bottom left here. In fact, there are some cases like this switch. It's good that the switch is here, because I don't want to step on the tables and touch the lights directly. So sometimes operating at the distance is a good thing. But at least I can compare and say, you know, does it make sense for this particular tool to be here rather than there? Another property of the instruments is what I've called the degree of integration. It's the sort of mapping between the degrees of freedom of the input device I'm using to the degrees of freedom that I'm trying to control. So if I do a scroll bar, this is a waste of information because I turned a 2D device into 1D signal. And so it's particularly bad when you have a vertical scroll bar and a horizontal one and you need to go, you know, from one to the other when your input device could do 2D to start with. But interestingly, you have the other way around, and this is from the Bryce virtual, what's called the virtual trackball, where with a 2D device, I can control 3 degrees of freedom. If I move the mouse cursor over this, I can turn the object in 3 directions. So this is a very good use, in fact, of the input device and the powerful instrument because of this. And then there is the degree of conformance, which is the similarity between the physical action and the effect on the object. So scroll bars are terrible for this because in order for the content of the document to move up, I need to move the thing down. We already discussed this, right? And some disagreement. But you know that Apple, on their latest version of the system, Lion, they've reversed all the scroll bars. And it's funny because the reaction is, oh, this is horrible, how can they do that? And then everybody who's used it for more than 2 days has been able to switch and cannot go back. So it's a thing where there were good reasons for this to work the way it did, because when you want the document to be at the top, when the elevator here is at the top, so the only way, you know, to make this go up is by this to go down, and so it makes sense from this perspective. But with the advent of touch-based interaction, where you scroll more like with this hand tool, which was started, I guess, by Acrobat, people were used to having the move of the document be the same, the move of the house, the touch. And then they retrofitted that into scrolling with the mouse wheel or the trackpad. And yes, at the beginning it's confusing because you've been trained to do this for 20 years, but finally it's not harder to do it the other way around, and in fact people don't find it a problem. So I'm quite proud of to say that I did that 10 years ago, and that there's finally someone who's taken the step to show that there was no good reason for doing it this way in the first place. Another example here is this notion of, you know, if I'm resizing text, I want to do it visually most of the time. But if I'm a typographer and I know this has to be 42 instead of 24, this will be a better interface for me. And so again, there's no right answer. And the purpose of these things is not to say this is good, this is bad, but to point out the differences so you can make an informed choice. And now we'll turn to the have 10 minutes for turn to the generative power, which I think is the most interesting part here. When we created this interface,
and we were thinking in terms of instruments. The problem is, okay, I'm thinking in terms of instrument. How do I do that? For some things, it gets fairly intuitive and easy, and for others, we didn't have easy solution. So we came up with three basic design principles to help us in this generative process. The first is reification. And reification, the idea is that a concept is turned into an interface object. Now, the scroll bar is a perfect example for this. You don't have scroll bars on your notebooks or on your books. So, scroll bar was an instrument that was invented to be able to navigate a document on the screen. So, it turned the concept of navigation into a physical object that is there, you can see, you can interact with it. So that's a process of reification. You go from an abstract command into a concrete interaction object. I will show guidelines as an example of reifying the notion of alignment. In many tools, when you want to align something, you select your objects, then you go into a menu or toolbar, and you say align, and align left, right, tops, you never know what's what, and usually you don't get the result you want. So what we did with the guidelines was to turn this notion of alignment into an object that is there to see and easy to interact with. So the second principle is polymorphism. And polymorphism is the notion that the same tool can act on objects of different natures. So we already know polymorphism in current interfaces, like cut, copy, and paste, apply to text, image, sound, whatever. But what if we push this further? The advantage if you do polymorphic commands is that you will be able to reuse these commands in multiple contexts. So anytime you have a command that applies to one object, you can apply it to a group of objects, which will mean apply it to each object in the group. And so if those objects are of different natures, if the command is polymorphic, it will work on more objects than if it's not. And so I think I'll have a quick example of this also in a moment. The last one is reuse. And this starts from the observation that most people don't do things from scratch. You always, or very often, start from something you've done before or something else has done before, and you modify it. So you reuse things a lot more than you create from scratch. So can we capture interaction so that reuse is more widespread? So we identified output reuse, where you reuse the output of former commands. So copy-paste is an obvious example of output reuse. Duplicate, but there's also input reuse, where you are reusing not the results of the command, but the commands themselves, the sequence of commands, so you can apply that sequence to another object. So redo is an example. Accessing the history or doing macros is a way of doing input reuse. Now, things get interesting when you combine these things. So let me show three examples. One is magnetic guidelines. And I will show that with a quick demo that will speak for itself. So here I create a number of objects. I create two horizontal guidelines, a vertical one. And how does it work? I drag this, and as I approach it, it attaches to that guideline. Now, you've seen that before. There's nothing fancy about this. Now, the thing is, now I can take this guideline and move it. And, of course, all the objects attached to it move with it. So not only I can create an alignment, but I can maintain this alignment by moving the guideline instead of moving the objects. I can do multiple constraints. So I can have it aligned to the vertical and horizontal, and we have made versions where there are guidelines that are different shapes. So it can be a segment, so objects are automatically distributed
evenly distributed and you can stretch the segment, or they can be a circle or a rectangle and they are automatically distributed over the shape. So what we're doing here is really reification, where the align command is turned into that green object. And now the green object is part of the objects I can manipulate. And then I can put polymorphism on this. If I had a color palette to change the colors of the object, I could color those objects. If I apply the color to the guideline, well, I could change the color of the guideline, but usually this is not really useful. But what it can do instead is change the colors of all the objects that are applied to it. Right? So my change color command is polymorphic in that it applies to regular objects, but also to guidelines. For guidelines, it does something a little bit different. And that increases the power of the system overall. So this is what we have here on this slide. And what we've done is decompose what used to be a long sequence of actions: select all the objects, go into the menu, bring the align command, get the dialog box, select if I align the top, the bottom, the this and that, say OK, and then everything gets crumpled in one pile because I select the wrong thing. I decompose that complex sequence of commands into simple things: creating a guideline. Then whenever I want to move things onto the guideline, add and remove objects, and then move the guideline itself. And these are all simple independent commands that, you know, once you've seen it, you know it. So another example is layers. That's something we use in CPN to control the complexity of what you see. So a layer can be a reification of a mode. In fact, in the tool, you know, I can show or hide the guidelines. Even if they are hidden, the guidelines are still there, so I can still sense the magnetic effect. But we also use a layer for the simulation information when there are tokens. And in fact, when you activate that layer, some simulation commands become available that were not available before. So a mode defines both what you see and what you can do. And this notion of layers and deciding what layers you want to see in each window helps manage this complexity in a way that users have found intuitive. And finally, groups combine reification and polymorphism in that when I group objects, I want to apply commands to the group. And so if I apply a polymorphic command, it will mean different things for different objects in the group, and it will allow me to do more things. And we've used groups in the tool for folders, for the hierarchy on the left, for the magnetic guidelines, as I explained, the guideline represents all the objects attached to it. And we also used it for defining styles. Because what is a style? When you use a style in a text editor, it's in fact a set of properties shared by a number of, say, paragraphs. So in a sense, it's the group of all the paragraphs that share this style. And so changing the style affects all the paragraph. And if you see it in this way, you have a sort of natural way of thinking of styles, not really as some new concept, but the concept of sharing properties between various objects. And so what we did was to create a style object, which is the collection of attributes, and then a style picker. I can use this picker tool here onto an object, and it will grab the style, which is here the thickness and the color, and highlight them in the style object. And then I can drop that style onto other objects. Now, this is something that has appeared recently in a number of tools, including, I think, in Office. So the point is not necessarily this is new. The thing is that it's inside the same framework as the other things I've been showing. This notion that you have tools or instruments that you can apply to objects, and using reification helps you identify which instruments make sense. Using polymorphism helps you apply these instruments to a larger collection of objects. And playing with reuse allows you to save the user doing everything from scratch and making things more reusable. So I want just to show you a little application of this. That will be the last little demo. It's about a search tool. How do you do search in most systems today? You say search, dialog box comes up, you enter the search string, you say search next, it shows you the next, and then you can say next, previews, etc. And then if you want to replace, you can replace and search next and all that. Again, very sequential form of interaction. Well, what I thought is that if you had a search instrument, it should show you all the results at once. So if I type here instruments, as I type, it highlights all the strings, and I can see them not only here, but also in the scroll bar. So I know that here, for a lot of the paper, I'm not talking about instruments, and then suddenly it shows up here. So I can go in the scroll bar, and I can see where it starts. So I'm going to type instrument. I can type instrumental, and in a blink, I can see that there's two occurrences here. And now let's replace instrument with tool. Well, so now that everything is selected, how I don't want to replace them all. So what happens is that now that I entered the replace string, I can select which instance I want to change, and they show up in red here on the right. If I'm not happy with tool, but I want to use, I don't know, let's put the French word, outil, it will replace everything that is being substituted as I type. And if I start typing here something, instrument, something, it will highlight as I type. So my search string specifies a sort of lens that highlights all the instances all the time. So again, this thing, I've seen since then some tools that use a similar approach, although I haven't seen it for doing the search and replace, but I haven't seen it so it shows you all the instances here. One last little thing about the scroll bar. This scroll bar works like a regular scroll bar, so you can scroll like this, and I can use the arrow to scroll line by line. Now, here is again this notion of degree of, what's it called? Using more of the input device. In fact, this is a joystick. If I move the cursor towards the top, I go faster. If I go down, I go slower, and then I go backwards. So I've turned this simple arrow into a joystick that allows me to navigate up and down just with a click of a button. I don't know if it's good or not, but this is the result of thinking of how can I make a scrolling instrument that does more things by better using what I have as an input device. Another option would be to use this and use the horizontal motion to do zooming in and out, which we've done in another piece of work. And again, the goal here is to show you the value of these generative principles to help you create sort of other forms of interaction that you may not have thought about first. And of course, then you have to prove that they are more efficient than other things. So, in summary, here's these three principles increase or can help increase simplicity by having more direct instruments, by reducing the number of commands, and by enlarging the number of things you can copy or redo rather than recreate from scratch. And at the same time, they increase power because with verification, commands can be first-class objects. In the CPM tools, I could take the tools in a palette, create my own tool palette, put that in the left part, which would save it with the document, and I could send you a document that includes the palettes I've used to create it. So commands, instruments become objects, first-class objects like the rest. Polymorphism, some commands work in multiple contexts, and with reuse, you get sort of a natural path to more scripting and programming, what we do in CPN tools is that you can see the history, and it's a piece of text that you can turn into your program and then edit to make it into a macro. So this is to show that even though we still have this trade-off between power and simplicity, we can shift the curve and have a bit more of both simplicity and power together. And that's it. Sorry, it was a bit rushed at the end. But I will put these available if you want to play with them. This is done with Tickle TK, so I did that 15 years ago. It still works on my Mac, so there's chances that it can work on your machines as well.